he said. We have not written to one another since... Your wound, she said. His womanly wound. I left your letters behind in Paris, he said, with everything of that life. I am fully a monk now, an abbot, a priest. She smiled. And I am a fully vowed woman, doubly vowed, once to Christ and ever to you. That has not changed. That he said nothing to this hurt her, but she would not let him see it. She smiled. You did not write. You did not come. You worry about appearances. The storied Abelard and Eloise together again, spawning gossip. That is what has kept you away. He said, I am here now. Because Count Theobald summoned you, he told me. That is why I am not surprised to see you. His lordship, in consultation with the abbot primate of Cluny, has seen to the elevation of the paraclete from oratory to conventual priory. But the granting of the monastic charter for women requires the naming of an ecclesiastical patron whose seal must be applied to the charter, and his lordship has seen to your appointment as our patron. Because you insisted upon it, he said, despite the bishop's objection. The bishop is a fool, she said. The count is right to ignore him. You have agreed to the appointment? Yes, Peter said, and she was relieved. But then he added, although I had a condition. What? She asked. The elevation from oratory to priory, I rejected that. I required it, she said coldly. What was this? Peter Abelard undercutting her? But she was wrong. At my insistence, he said, the elevation is to a status above priory, to abbey. He smiled, expecting her to be pleased. The paraclete is to be an abbey with canonical exemption. You are to be an abbess. He paused, letting the full weight of the good news land. Then he added, you will have the right to the crozier and the ring. Abelard's smile broadened. You and Suger will be peers. I care nothing for Suger, she said, not expecting to be believed. Suger was her nemesis, and this turn would punish him. Her smile matched Peter's and conveyed her delighted surprise. You are the peer I want, she said. And then, boldly, she asked, will you stay with us? That is impossible, sister. Appearances, she said. I am the abbot of Saint-Gildas de Rouy. Hic sunt leones, she said. Your monastery is in the far-away land of dragons and lions, where the language of the Celts is spoken. Yes, far away, dear sister. In the west, she said, well north of Nantes. She paused, allowing the laden place name to fall between them with all its weight. Then she asked quietly, what word have you? She could not bring herself to mention him, their son. But Peter understood. Lucille has sent word on occasion. He fares well. He folds in fully with the growing children of Marcus. He is beloved and safe. We were right in what we did. I have him in my nocturnal litany, she said. Habitually, I hand him over to the care of our Heavenly Father. As do I, he smiled. But by what name, as Peter or Astrolabe? As both, Eloise laughed, and then he did. Their bond of love, still vital despite everything, was a triple weave, including their child evermore. Relief had come into her heart, and it prompted her to push him, as she had of old. She said, I ask for your presence at the paraclete, and you decline. So be it. But you should be where the influence of Master Peter Abelard can be felt. As it is, in your remote outpost, you are almost ignored. I know that you fear gossip, but you are in danger of being remembered more for the scandal we caused long ago than for your current application of reason to belief. Is this obscurity what you truly want? My influence is a matter of my writing now, he said steadily. I am at my table all through daylight and even with candles at night. I have scribes at my elbow taking dictation. So your monks know Latin? Abelard shrugged, conveying disdain for his own situation. Some do. Enough, apparently, she nodded. The writing of Peter Abelard travels. Your books are copied and passed from one scriptorium to another, including mine. I have them. Your treatise on Ezekiel, your Theologia, your Sic et Non. I read you. The warmth of her regard made her voice full-throated now. But apart from your most devoted followers and from disapproving critics, your readers are far fewer than is right. The master teacher's lectern, raised upon a podium, is where you belong, not the scriptorium. You belong in the city, not the edge of wilderness, a school, not a monastery. Your work as a writer will find its future only in your work as a master. Even more than here at the Paraclete, you belong back in Paris, Peter Abelard. I am content to make my case on the page. Your case is too important to remain there. Limbo, for example. Limbo, what of it? You openly question St. Augustine's doctrine that unbaptized infants are doomed. And what is your argument? That such cruelty to the little ones renders meaningless the love of God. There's the key. You use love as the measure of truth, not church discipline, not tradition, not the sacraments, love. You must expand upon that. How? He asked. Moving from infants to infidels. God loves them, too. Make that case. Infants, he said, by definition are innocent. Was the thief on the cross beside our Lord innocent? She asked. Was he baptized for that matter? Yet he was promised paradise. You have honed your disputation skills, sister. She nodded. She was surprisingly at ease. Her hands were at rest upon the architect's drawings, a vivid symbol of her authority. Authority braced her tone. Your own Theologia Christiana points to how infidels too can be innocent, she declared. Pagan philosophers, Hebrews of old, Jews of today, all of us sinners, the loving Father takes into account what his children intend, all his children, including your humble servant. Here she half bowed, with more than a hint of self-mockery. I learned this lesson well from you, how to trust my own desire. Yes, husband, desire. This is why I refuse to regret who we were to one another, who in my case I still am. Your God, when I knew you, was not a God of law, but of love. I am your living reminder of that. Abelard faced away. Framed by the doorway behind him, he stood tall. He, too, was strong. She was relieved to sense that he was still a match to her. He said, "The law is what love looks like, sister, when it comes to us in time and finitude." He paused. Strong, yes, but not stone. His voice shook slightly when he added, "As for our love, I would that you transfer what you felt for me to the love of Christ. Not felt, she said. Still, he said, it is Christ, she cut him off. My Christ, she said, is the Christ I have from you. Eloise refused to lower her eyes. She waited for him to turn back to her. When he did not, she said, not the God who wills sacrificial suffering, but the Lord who rushes out to greet the wayward child. Sacrificial suffering, sister, looks different to me now. When we were young, life was grand. That changed, for me at least. Now it is in sorrows that I meet the Holy One. She said, forgive me if I presume to say, one can be too fond of tribulation. At last he turned back to her. In my case, he said, the sorrows are deserved. Because of me? I was properly punished, he said firmly. I do not judge what you were. What you are, that is admirable. People who admire me now as chaste do not know what a hypocrite I am. God knows, however. I have not changed since lust defined me. Lust for you. His face burned at her words, at least that. If there had been another chair by her table, she'd have invited him to sit. That he remained standing was making their encounter all too formal. That formality was the hedge behind which he could hide. But what did she expect using the word lust? Even in their heyday, he colored at that. She went on, God knows this of me, my unrepentant longing, and still declines to judge. God is no heavenly magistrate balancing scales, offense against punishment. I learned this from you as well, Peter Abelard. There is no appeasing God because God does not need appeasement. God is love, pure and simple. That was your lyric. I no longer write songs. Good. You write theology now. Do that, Peter Abelard. Make your case with power. Speak it aloud. Follow your logic wherever it leads. That is what you used to demand of me. And now, demanding it of me, he said, you would see my books burned? No. She slapped her hand down on the table. I would see them read. Once read, your words will fly. Your scholars and then your readers will see to your vindication how the logic of Peter Abelard leads inexorably to the one true faith. Ah, but there you miss the delicate point, sister. What makes me contentious is that I give primacy to logic, not faith. I think. That begins everything. I think. We cannot believe what we do not understand. I am accused of preferring thought to faith, and of that I am guilty. I presume to contradict the great Anselm, who has become holy writ. But I must do it from afar. To hold what I hold is dangerous. That is why I retired from the schools. Eloise heard these words with a heavy heart. The great man of her youth. Still emasculated? But sensing his bleak condition opened her all at once to her own responsibility. Her role now was to help Master Peter Abelard, to be Master Peter Abelard. She said quietly, far off in the Celtic hinterland, you are living in the past. The future needs you in the present. The church needs you in the fray. And so do I. Leave the church aside, sister. What do you need of me? Apart from another form of address than sister, there can be no other. Then be a father to the Paraclete. Be our counselor and guide, even if from a distance and only by your writing. How so? The rule, for example. Abbot Suger made it clear that our rule is inadequate. The rule of Benedict, he began, is for men, she said. I need a rule for women, legislating matters from the ridiculous to the sublime. What is ridiculous, he asked. Benedict's rule forbids underwear. I care not to speak for monks, but nuns need underwear, for 1 week a month at least. She paused, then added with a soft smile, once I could have said such a thing without causing you to blush. But she'd misunderstood his embarrassment, as she saw when he said, I wear underwear, needing it more than once a month. This reference to a condition caused by his castration silenced her, but only for a moment. She said quietly, that has never mattered to me. He said, still, it matters. He forced a smile. So much for ridiculous. What is your sublime reason for needing a rule? She wanted simply to stand and go to him. She wanted to take him in her arms, but she was confused now. Was this feeling the old longing for her lover, or was it pity? She reined in the emotion to say, with what detachment she could muster, the rule for the Abbey of the Paraclete should measure duties and responsibilities of nuns against the duties and responsibilities of the women whom our Lord called as apostles. Disciples, she said, not apostles. But you yourself say otherwise, calling Mary of Magdala apostle to the apostles. Her anointing of Jesus is what made him Christ, the Anointed One. So you say, Mary is the exemplar of love. Love must be the soul of the rule. Teach us that. In your writing, you deny that women were taken from Adam's rib. Women, too, directly from the hand of God. Declare that aloud. Construct a rule on it. Give us the true mysteries of faith. Write to us. I will turn the refectory into the repository of your instruction. At each meal, my postulants will read aloud everything you send. May I depend on it? Yes, sister, you may. Thank you, Peter Abelard. She had succeeded in restoring the necessary equilibrium, and so had he. It wasn't what she wanted, but it was what their condition required if they were to have a future. A future. Enough. She stood. She came out from behind her table. When he made no move toward her, she simply pointed the way with her hand, and, obedient, he turned. Eloise walked with him then, but only as far as the pile of stones that would become the garden wall. They parted without touching. As she watched him go, she touched her breast for the substance of his hidden letter and for the compact mass of the ring she had from him. She thought, he imagines me as a bride of Christ, but I am a Stoic of Rome. Chapter 19. Rachel Vedette routinely rode the bus from Hoboken into the city, but today, instead of filing with the morning commuters into the tunnel complex of the subway, she found herself strolling in the early afternoon from the bus terminal at 41st Street to the western extremity of 50th Street, where, if he was right, she would find Pier 88. A dusting of snow was swirling about, But the November sky was brightly organized around the yellow haze of an insistent sun, a benign promise that seemed wrong, given the dark weather of her own feelings. What did she want? Why had she agreed to this? She was a fool. First to appear as she approached the river was neither a moored ship nor the massive terminal he had described, but rather the hulking elevated highway that cut the city off from its Hudson waterfront. In the shadows of the steel and concrete structure, the cobblestone street bustled with trucks and taxis vying for curb space or pushing into the cavernous cargo halls of the pier storehouses. Men in overalls and caps tugged at dollies or shouldered wheeled carts loaded down with steamer trunks and luggage. At corners, policemen waved and whistled as streams of well-dressed New Yorkers moved at a happy clip through the chilled underworld below the highway. Rachel fell in with them, to all appearances just another gawker come to see a ship set sail. But to her, the scene, extending for blocks, was chaotic, not festive. The frenzy only heightened her sense of dislocation. She had been at these piers once before, but not like this. Rounding a corner at the last of the looming storehouses, and suddenly emerging from beneath the highway, she found herself in the open, confronted with a long view of a mammoth ocean liner moored to a pier across a broad stretch of harbor backwater. The ship was the size of a Manhattan skyscraper, as if toppled on its side and reaching far out into the river. The hull was black, the decks rising up were white, and from a pair of slanted back oval-shaped funnels flew lines of flutter with hundreds of triangle pennants, red, white, and blue. Strains of some snappy show tune could be heard drifting from the ship across the distance, and reflections off an orchestra's brass and silver instruments could be seen to shimmer on the deck just below the captain's bridge. Tiny figures lined the railings. Emblazoned across the hull, in gleaming white letters amidships, was the word America. Now the lightly falling flakes, salting the scene like the flitter of a child's crystal snow globe, seemed a function of magic. For a moment, Rachel let go of her habitual wariness, releasing herself to the spectacle. Amazing, eh? She knew his voice at once. Father Michael Cavanaugh, speaking from only steps behind her. She turned. His face was vivid with delight. He seemed slightly winded, having apparently just crossed out from under the girders. He was bareheaded, wearing an open-collared blue shirt, but also, against the chill, a long black topcoat, the outer garb of a priest. At the sight of him, her heart, from its place of uplift, sank. She was alone on Mondays, because solitude was her natural state. His evident accessibility, by contrast, underscored the depth of her reticence, which, in turn, made this defiance of it feel dangerous. Why had she come here? But instead of turning to walk away, she found it possible to say, "Hello, Father." Her diffidence was nothing to him, nor, she realized then, had his elation to do with her. His eyes were on the ship. He seemed younger than before. "She casts off in less than an hour," he said. "We should make our way over there to the portside dock, where the send-off gang gathers. That's us." Now he looked at her, grinning. She sensed that he was going to take her by the elbow, but instead he pointed, "Here come the tugboats!" He led the way through the crowd, moving gracefully, a man accustomed to deference but not forcing it. He was easy to follow. They lost sight of the ship as they drew even with a three-story, red-brick building with a flamboyantly carved pediment reaching skyward above a columned portico, the marine terminal, standing between the endpoint of the pier and the street. They joined a line patiently filing through the terminal gate and out onto the dock. When Kavanaugh and Rachel cleared the entrance, the first thing that registered immediately to the left was the looming bow of the ship. Seen up close and from below, it seemed more like a mammoth black wall than the graceful cutwater Rachel had seen from the distance. But then, coming fully onto the pier, as its planks broadened and ran out into the water for nearly the entire length of the SS America, Rachel saw the most startling vista of all. Down from the soaring decks of the ship were drifting dozens, hundreds, no, thousands of delicate ribbons, thin streamers in every color of the rainbow. Most were already fixed, wafting in the breeze and impossibly tangled, a gossamer web. But other streamers were still falling, unfurling, like lines connecting the dots of the tiny bits of snow. Indeed, the snow itself was compounded now by, in addition to streamers, thrown confetti. The very air had color. The sight made Rachel gasp, a visceral elation with which she was entirely unacquainted. She almost reached ahead to Michael Kavanaugh, but he pressed on through the crowd. Still, as if he'd sensed her uncharacteristic impulse, he did then let his arm drift back toward her, apparently aiming to pull her along. Though she did not take his hand, she quickened her pace to stay up. The streamers fluttered. She saw what was happening. From the decks, the ship's passengers were throwing colored discs into the air while holding fast to one end. The ribbons spooled out as they fell. Only when Kavanaugh, half-leaping, caught the loose end of a ribbon, did she realize that such snagging on the pier was the point. All around them, the festive well-wishers were seizing streamers that linked them randomly to the travelers high above. With shouts and waves, though, some landlubbers were ecstatic to find themselves joined to particular people who, equally thrilled, could be seen craning down over the ship's railing. Kavanaugh clutched a second streamer and turned and handed her the end. Red. "Look up," he said happily. "Figure out who this ribbon pairs you with. That's who you've come to send off." Through the tangle of elongated tapes, confetti, and the swirling snow, Rachel traced the color red of her particular thread, up and up. Well free of a snarl above the midpoint of the hull, the red streamer, proudly distinct, looped up to the rail of the main deck. There, holding the other end, was an adolescent girl in a bright green beret and a matching green coat. She was wearing white gloves, which made the wild waving of her free hand all the more jubilant. With her other hand, she held the red ribbon up in the triumph of having identified Rachel, her partner. The girl called down to her words that Rachel could not make out in the cacophony, which included, as she heard it now, the orchestra's rendition of "Happy Days Are Here Again." "Wave to her," Kavanaugh said gently. Only then did Rachel realize that she'd been standing like a statue, conveying nothing of her buoyant absorbedness. She did wave, but cautiously. Kavanaugh's streamer was purple. He leaned to Rachel and said, "The red ones are the best. Red means you too will take a trip." "Why should red mean that?" He shrugged. "Red for the navigational slogan, Red Right Return. You'll be sailing home." His words meant nothing to her. She wrapped the end of her ribbon twice around her hand, while still waving shyly. Above, the girl in green tugged at the man beside her, a father perhaps, and now he too waved down. Rachel was aware of the snow upon her own upturned face. But otherwise, the field of her concentration had been taken over entirely by the girl. The sounds of music, laughter, joyous shouting were all surpassed suddenly by the soaring blast of the ship's horn. Like the hands of many others, Rachel's went involuntarily to her ears, although she, like the others, continued to clutch the ribbon. The horn fell silent as abruptly as it had sounded. All other noise had quieted. Kavanaugh leaned to her again. "Brace yourself, two more blasts, the signal that she's moving astern." The second sharp horn sound was, if anything, louder. The girl on the deck above was clutching her ears, too, but her gaze was fixed upon Rachel, and then she was waving again. No sooner had the third blast sounded than the ship began to ease away. Now a cry went up in unison from the dockside crowd, and their waving took on a frantic edge. The onboard band broke into Auld Lang Syne. As the ship moved, the streamers, held fast in a thousand fists, began to go taut. Curls and loops disappeared as one by one the ribbons stretched. On board the ship, the passengers waved and waved. Hands went to mouths for the blowing of kisses. The draping red ribbon that joined Rachel to the girl in green went straight, and other ribbons now began to snap as the ship pulled away. The rainbow tracery was breaking apart. No, Rachel thought. It suddenly mattered that her one precious streamer not break. Eyeing the girl, Rachel pushed past Kavanaugh to go with the ship to keep the tape intact. It grew tighter and tighter, but held. The ribbon held. How could such a thing have significance? Yet it did. Rachel began to throw kisses to the girl, who threw them back and once again began calling to her. Now, though, Rachel heard the words. "I love you," the girl cried. "I love you." At that, Rachel's streamer went slack, and the broken end fell from high up, curling down, down into the channel of seething water that separated the dock from the hull. Rachel continued to hold on to the remnant tape, unconsciously winding it around her hand. The ship made way ever more swiftly. The bow, passing by, loomed with a menace that drew Rachel's gaze high up to the word America, emblazoned above the anchor flukes. She cast her eyes forward once more to find the girl in green, but the child was lost in the suddenly undifferentiated mass of passengers at the rail. Gone. Rachel realized that Kavanaugh, standing nearby, was staring at her. She saw that his cheeks were awash with tears, which startled her, but also underscored how unmoored she herself had become. She was given neither to tears nor to ready sentiment of any kind. Yet she had just been unaccountably moved by a stilted commercial ritual, a debarkation she knew was staged. Still, the stirred feelings were real. She felt drawn to the priest simply because he was a fellow human being who had, for his own reasons, a long-lost father, a mystery friend returned, been ambushed by a grief of farewell, to which he was, unlike her, capable of giving expression. His show of feeling forced her to acknowledge, if only to herself, that she too had been waylaid. Then, abruptly, she realized her enormous mistake. His face was not wet with tears, but with melted snow. Her own cheeks, she realized, were wet for the same reason. She turned away from him. Mere foolishness could not define her. It was not that she had misread the man. It was that she had wanted him to be weeping, so that the difference between them could be clear. She had forgotten for a moment what she was, an orphaned animal, alone, hungry, and perhaps dangerous. That an abyss had opened between her and everything else was the indelible fact of her condition. Who was she to imagine that a line could be thrown to her, or that she would in any case know how to reach for it? To have been dropped with the snapping of that ridiculous streamer back into the bottomless pit of desolation made her joltingly short of breath. She brought a hand to her chest to press her lungs, the hand around which by now was wrapped the red ribbon. With the ship underway, the send-off gang slouched back toward the city, lazily funneling through the gates at the marine terminal. As abruptly as the flurries of snow had come, now they disappeared, as if its own romantic weather accompanied the departing ship. Without waiting for instruction from the priest, Rachel turned and went the other way, toward the river, not the streets. He followed her, but she did not care. They advanced against the crowd, pushing farther out toward the pierhead, as if hawsed to the ship, which was sliding into the open river with remarkable speed. Having begun to move her legs and arms, blood pumping, Rachel found that the unexpected flood of emotion started to ebb, which enabled her to resume breathing almost normally. Yet she was still in the grip of the oceanic free fall through the cavern of her chest. To come out of herself, she focused on the surrounding scene and was immediately struck by the dapper look of the ladies and gentlemen shouldering past. The coiffed hair, bright scarves, suede gloves, fedoras, coat collars upturned just so, an inventory of style. Most seemed paired off as couples with arms linked. They carried on an easy interchange of laughing chatter. The laughter was like an unknown foreign language, sparking an alienation that drew her back into preoccupation with herself. She was dressed in black, as always, yet today, away from her workplace, she was wearing loose-fitting black trousers instead of a long skirt. That, together with her cloak and turban, set her apart, a woman of sorrows, compared with these partygoers, assuming they even saw her. But with her cape flying as she pushed through, of course they saw her. Rachel chastised herself for being a willful misfit, a gitan, the gypsy card reader for whom the rough French cigarette was named. But she rebuked herself for foolishness again. What is a gypsy here? Who reads cards, and what, for that matter, in this city of technicolor dreams, is a woman in black, if not one hoping to be gawked at? She was pathetic. Soon she was free of the crowd, and Kavanaugh was right behind her. She slowed her pace. He caught up, and they walked shoulder to shoulder, rattling the planking as they went. Again she took in the scene to escape herself. Across the water, tugboats nudged the magnificent SS America, turning it slowly, so that soon enough it once again showed itself broadside. She turned to him, pointing at the ship. "Your brother, perhaps? You said he's a tugboat captain." Kavanaugh laughed. "No. Jerry's is a pushboat, barges and scows, not ocean liners. Nothing glamorous like this. Staten Island with the working stiffs, not Manhattan with the swells." Rachel watched the ship for a moment longer, then resumed walking. At the end of the long wharf, beside a flagstaff flying the eagle-adorned ensign of the United States lines, was a slatted wooden bench. The sun had broken fully through, a completed shift in weather that invited them to sit. In silence, they watched the ocean liner gliding downriver toward the Statue of Liberty. Tugboats drifted away from her, first one, then a second, then a third, leaving the ship to her transcendent solitude. Rachel, for her part, was glad for company now, a rescue from bleak inwardness. She wanted to ask the priest a question, but it refused to take shape in her mind. Obviously, because of the ever-shrinking ship, the question had to do with departure. She toyed with the red streamer on her hand, rewinding it around the spool of her fist. "During the war," Kavanaugh said quietly, "she carried troops. Her hull was painted a swirling gray and white and silver, camouflage. She's so fast, she would outrun her destroyer escort, so she would cross the Atlantic alone. She outran the U-boats, too. I used to watch her come and go from Brooklyn." "But were there streamers?" she asked. "No," Kavanaugh laughed. "Although the Navy band was there, playing Anchors Away instead of Auld Lang Syne." Rachel surprised herself by saying, "I looked at you back there and thought I saw tears on your face, but it was melting snow." "It might have been tears," he answered kindly. "Who's to say?" But when he smiled, she thought perhaps he was teasing her. Then she saw he was teasing himself. He said, "I saw the snow on your face, too." She said, "Yes, snow. Only snow." "Still, I was not prepared for such feeling. It was, we say, heureux et triste. Happy, sad. That young girl at the rail above, did you see her? In green. Your girl. You had her streamer holding the other end. She was calling to you." "Yes." Rachel could not bring herself to say, "I think she was calling, I love you." Instead, Rachel gestured with the ribbon on her hand and said, "The surprise was in what this a établi, you say, established between us. Then, when it broke." "You found that sad?" Kavanaugh asked. "I was invaded by feelings. Envahi." "There was a man with the girl," Kavanaugh said. "Perhaps you noticed. I suppose it was her father." "Yes, I saw." "And perhaps that made you think of your father, if you don't mind my mentioning him. A father and daughter." Already, in this conversation, Rachel felt not only that she was impersonating someone, La Gitane, but that by contrast, he was being entirely himself. How had he come so quickly back to Papa? He knew to do that because yesterday, when he broached the subject, she had cut him off, which only flagged her father as unfinished business. Now Kavanaugh was gently returning to it, having prepared the way by speaking of the ship and its service in the war, by taking seriously the implications of her red ribbon, by having noted what passed between her and the girl. But then, was this not what a good priest did? Observe, listen, by observing and listening, understand? Then she wondered, how had she come to the knowledge of his goodness? Yesterday she had pictured him with patients at the hospital, but that had been abstract. Was this what priests did when hearing confessions? She turned her face to him, the day's first direct meeting of their eyes. Yes, he listened. He understood. And he offered an opening, one through which she was not yet prepared to go. She veered, saying, "I thought in bringing me to the West Side docks you were inviting me to know your father, the longshoreman. Was that not the point? what this place means to you? He answered, This pier wasn't here in Pop's day. There was a shorter one, all slanted pilings and creosote and splinters galore. But out here, jutting into the Hudson, it feels the same. This was my special place. My brothers and I were river rats, taking every chance we got to clamber aboard a boat, usually a work skiff or a dinghy. It's how Jerry wound up in tugboats, and I would have too, but he hesitated and had to make a fresh decision whether to go on. He said, Actually, I was a solitary boy, most myself out here alone, looking across the river to the other shore. In those days, you saw no buildings over there, just woods. I used to feel that I was looking not so much at Jersey, but at the whole rest of the country. Go west, young man, go west. After Pop died, this was where I did my thinking about him, the feel of my hand in his, which was calloused but always gentle, the aroma of his skin, the rough stubble on his cheek when he kissed me goodnight. He was everything I loved about where I was from. But where was I going? Out here, the past bled into the future. So what I saw stretching out past Jersey was the whole span of time, too. I loved the feeling here, that I was looking at my life to come. Your life in the church? From a certain point on, sure. From harbor boats to the bark of St. Peter, he laughed, and he looked away. His discomfort showed, and she sensed how rare this was, his explaining himself. With his gaze soft upon the far river bank, he went on. The parish priest was the neighborhood hero, and it seemed normal, inevitable, to want to be like him. It doesn't take a psychiatrist to get the connection between the father I'd lost and the father I soon found. Becoming a priest, obviously, was the answer to a question I'd begun to ask when Pop died. But it took me a while to get there. Looking back, I see that that's what I was doing with my solitary brooding out here on the pier. Brooding? She asked. He shrugged. I would learn to call it contemplation. But before I settled on the seminary, I wasn't attuned so much to a future, with a whole lot of specifics defining it, but to the future, if you catch the distinction, open-ended, the way that landscape across the river struck me, rolling on from sea to shining sea, looking west is an American habit, they say, because it's as wide open as tomorrow. Geography and time, reflecting one another. Is that the difference between Europe and the States? One looks back, the other looks ahead. The past is what makes you French. The future is what makes you American. Me? Yes. Am I American? If you want to be, he said. He faced her again to say emphatically, You get to decide. One does not get to decide, she said, about the givens of the past. That's true. But you decide what they mean to you. Isn't that what your father's project was regarding Abelard? Trying to change what Abelard's meaning was? He waited for her to affirm what he'd said. When she remained silent, he went on. From what you said, your father didn't regard the givens of Abelard's past or past understandings about him as closing off a different future, or is that presumptuous of me? No. It suggests you have been listening. She did not know when she had looked so steadily into the eyes of a man. He did not look away. He said, You told me you wanted to talk about it. Yes, she said, about Abelard and Eloise. Which means your father. Yes. Although I did not realize that until... You... At last she dropped her gaze. Her eyes settled on her hands, which were clasped in her lap. She'd forgotten the red ribbon. Feelings stirred up in the wake of the ship's departure still washed through her, a complicating countercurrent to far older feelings from which she was normally walled off. Though it seemed obvious now that she saw it, Rachel was startled to recognize that her impulsively giving the Historia to the priest was as much about her father as about the text. With this stranger, she was at last forcing herself to reckon with her own, yes, grotesquely unfinished business. She said, "I have not talked about my father, or his project, as you call it, because he failed." Rachel stopped. What she had just said was false. The truth was, she did not talk about her father because of her failure, not his. She allowed the silence to settle, and soon the silence became its own palpable presence, like a third party between them. Once again, her mute immobility was a cul-de-sac from which there would be no exit. But no, this time she was not alone, and her partner in the silence could break it. Understanding, apparently, the need for a pivot, Kavanaugh said with a self-mocking laugh, "That was some U.S. civics lesson of mine, eh? The great American narrative looking west, the mythic power of the future, time and space joined on the wild frontier, which is what we New Yorkers call New Jersey." His inflection signaled the punchline of a joke, but she did not get it. He continued, "That unfenced future is why, though, I could never become French, you could certainly become American. Open-endedness makes for the famous American innocence." "Innocence," she said. "Innocence abroad. How we Americans are always starting over, moving on. Who knows what's out there? Believe it or not, I've been feeling that way myself, for the first time in years, this week, since I met you. Experience over doctrine, you said yesterday. You were talking about Abelard, and you mentioned Galileo, but you could have been talking about me." "Your business with the bishop?" she asked. "A long time ago. He lied to me. That lie, experience, is like a flawed brick down low in a wall. Doctrine. If you cut into the wall to replace the brick, pretty soon you're having to move every other brick in the entire structure." "Does the wall fall?" she asked. "That is the question, Miss Vedette. That sure is the question. I have to take it up with His Excellency. I'll begin by explaining about ethics over creed." Kavanaugh grinned. "Maybe I'll quote Abelard." "Quote Eloise," she said. "She's the true genius." He laughed and nodded, a wholehearted gesture of agreement. Then he veered. "Maybe I'll just tell the bishop about the coming and going of ships, what started us on this." "Us?" she asked. What had she to do with his bishop? He shrugged. "Yesterday, I suggested we come down here to the docks just for the fun of it. But fun hardly applies to this chat of ours, wouldn't you say?" "You have a history here," she said, "and it carries weight. Because of Pop, that's true. But also because of the war." He was suddenly solemn. "Did I say I was in the Navy? You said Brooklyn just now." "Yes, the Brooklyn Navy Hospital. Chaplain." "And you still serve a hospital?" "Yes. It's the heart of what I do. a priest at the side of the patient's bed. That experience, actually, is what passes for my doctrine. The bedside of those in pain is where I most belong. But during the war, I was down on the docks all the time, too, sending my lads off on troop ships, and then receiving them when they came home. Speaking of sad. And in your case, haunting everything. The Titanic. So we have a theme going here. What was it you said? Heureuse? Or triste? Kavanaugh pulled a pack of cigarettes from his pocket. A bit presumptuously, he put two in his mouth and lit them, then handed one to Rachel. She took it gratefully. He said, "But you must have arrived in New York by ship, no?" "Yes, down there." She tossed her head toward the Statue of Liberty. "Ellis Island," he supplied. "And the very long lines," she said. "When was that?" "More than a year ago, nearly 2 years."
"You mean 1948?
"Yes. Why?"
"The year Truman let the DPs in. Was that you?"
She considered what to say, then spoke slowly.
"It was carefully explained to me that I was not displaced. I was not stateless. I was French. Nevertheless, I was expelled from Europe. We were all called DPs, because Truman could not bring himself to call us Jews. But that is what we were. Israelites. In France, I stopped being French."
"You were in a camp?"
Rachel, instead of replying, focused on the study of her cigarette. That this man, a stranger, really, had pushed through to that question might have surprised her. But she coldly acknowledged its inevitability. She herself had made it inevitable. Now that the word had been spoken and spoken by him, there was no question of not answering. "More than one," she said. "The camp for Jews, run by Germans. And then, after the liberation, a second camp for, shall we say, les délinquants, the delinquents. Liberation for some of us was delayed."
"I don't understand," he said. She looked at him sharply. "Collaborators, traitors, c'est moi. Surely you heard how we French turned on one another at the war's end." She shrugged, a willed gesture of indifference. Of course he would not understand. She went on. "And then, third, a relocation camp, which was organized by the Americans. From that camp, I came here, to the United States. By then I was, yes, displaced, no matter what they called me." She took a hefty drag on her cigarette. In exhaling, it was as if she had just taken her first breath in years, also as if she would not be allowed another. "It is a long story," she said, by which she meant there was nothing more to say. She would go back to holding her breath. She looked downriver. The ship was small beyond the statue, approaching the mouth of the harbor. Its one streamer now was a thin line of smoke, trailing from one of the two funnels. She thought of the ship suddenly as an emblem of herself. She was gone like that, sailed away. She said, "It is cold. Are you not cold?"
"Yes, but..." She looked at him and, despite herself, asked, "What?"
"I am trying to understand what has brought us to this moment. I came upon you at the Cloisters, a place, to my surprise, full of implication for both of us. I did not intend to impose on you, but because of events unleashed in my own life just now, I seem to have done just that. You have been helpful to me,
as I navigate some unexpected swells.